Okay, so good morning and welcome to this lecture. So I'm François David and I am a theoretical physicist working in Saclay in France. That's a big theory institute. I'm in charge of this QFT course since the beginning of the program. So I'm very happy to be here again. I hope I do a good job. So I learned from Dan that you are allowed to ask questions to Dan, who is going, I don't know, maybe to filter them and then send them back to me. But so don't hesitate first to raise hand and ask questions to me. And if I don't know really how to answer, I will redirect them to Dan. Okay. So I'm very happy to have Dan again as a fellow to work with me. I'm very happy to have also benefited from the previous lectures. I looked at that. So my course is about QFT2. Oh, one last thing. Of course, you can also walk and knock at my office. I'm just beside the office, in front of the office of Dan Gong. You can also send a mail to me if I'm not around. I'm here for the whole 4 weeks, and so I'll be relatively free to available for you if you want to chat with me or have questions or at the lunch and the dinner, since I'm here alone, so I will spend time in the institute. I will be happy if you come, because I'm also the head of my institute now, so I'll be busy with some sending mail and answering the phone. So you will be a useful, not distraction, but change. So please feel free to ask questions now and during the day. Okay, so, and of course, you can also send mail to me. So my email is just my name, françoisapp.david@iphth.fr. iphth is for Institut de Physique Théorique. Okay. Okay. So this course is about QFT2. So it's going to be a continuation and deepening and presentation of new aspects of quantum field theory one. And you had an introduction to, not more than an introduction, presentation and of quantum field theory by Dan and Gong, using canonical formulation. So you are supposed to know everything about canonical quantization of a quantum field theory, at least for the simple case like the scalar free field, the Klein-Gordon field, and the a bit of QED. Well, not more than a bit of QED and Dirac theory of fermions. Okay, so you had QFT1. One, which is canonical quantization. You had also, of course, before that, an introduction to quantum theory. By Agata and Maite. Maite this year did an in-depth presentation of path integrals quantization. In addition to canonical quantization using Hilbert space and operators and Schrödinger equation. I'm going to rely on that, but maybe I'll assume that you learned too much. So if you have some question about what I'm going to state about path integral quantization, just raise your hand. Okay. I won't be using the part of the quantum theory course on the operational formalism, which has been given by Agata, because that's not that useful. Or in fact, it raised a lot of interesting question, but the theory of quantum information in a quantum field theory relativistic system is less advanced than in non-relativistic system, which is the regime where quantum, well, quantum experiment, quantum system, manipulation of quantum systems works in the everyday life. Okay. But keep in mind that this is also useful. So you are allowed to ask questions about that. I know a bit about it. And be also be aware that both the canonical quantization and path integral quantization of quantum theory and this operational formalism dealing with preparation, manipulation, and then projection of measurements is, in fact, more or less mathematically equivalent. You can view quantum theory, including quantum theory, field theory, from very different point of view. But quantum theory is, for many aspects, unique. As long as you don't deal with a real fundamental problem of understanding what is space-time from the point of view of a quantum theory, what is relation with quantum theory, with quantum gravity and all that, where we are still a lot of ideas are around, many progress, but still it's not very well understood. That's what makes quantum high energy physics and theoretical physics so fascinating, at least for me. Okay. That's what I'm going to rely on. And also, I'm going to discuss that a bit later. I will also use concepts that you learned in the statistical mechanics course by Pedro. Okay. So the introduction, so the purpose of this course, as I've been ordered by Neil Turok, and then by, is that I have to introduce you with three things, basically. First, what is the path integral formulation of a quantum field theory? So in a quantum field theory, which is a theory of relativistic quantum fields where you can create and annihilate particles, and you must think about the system not just as particle, as or waves for single particles, wave functions, but as quantum fields. What is the analog of the path integral quantization? And that's called functional integral quantization. So replace trajectory of particles, path particles, by trajectory in field space. Yes?
You said something about measurement in quantum field theory. Are we going to study that in this course? If not, can you say a few words about it?
I can say that I don't know much about it. But yes, I think there is a theory. You have projection operators, you have operators. But you must think about what is a measurement in a quantum field theory as measurement only in a subpart of space-time or space and time, because you make a measurement in high-energy physics, for instance, at CERN or in experiments. You are probing what's happening in a definite region of space, your detector, during a finite duration of time. But the quantum states is the quantum states of the whole quantum field on whole space. So you can never just state, consider that I'm considering a definite quantum system, which is there. That's a particle, that's a photon, that's something happening in a quantum circuit, and make measurement about it. So it's a difference from my point of view. But I prefer not to say more. Okay. Is it? Who asked this question? No. That's an anonymous process. Ah, that's an anonymous process. Okay, I understood. But you shouldn't be afraid. So maybe I should have a pool of other lecturers and reply only anonymously. Okay. Okay. So the second part of the course, so that's, this is going to cover the basically the first, I'm teaching for 4 weeks, so the first part of the course. Then I'm going to discuss what is renormalization theory, And I presume you have heard the name, renormalization. I don't know if you discuss that or problem of divergent short distance high energy in the quantum theory course. Dan? That's a question for you.
Some brief reference.
Yeah, so brief. Okay. So the need of renormalization theory, so which is a procedure to deal with possible problems arising at high energy and short distance, is very specific to quantum field theory. And that's what makes it unique and also applicable. So I'm going to discuss some aspects of renormalization theory. And at that stage, I can say that you have learned about renormalization theory in a different context, which is statistical mechanics, the study of critical phenomena, critical systems, systems with very long correlation lengths. Okay, so it's specific to quantum field theory, but it's also specific to statistical mechanics and condensed matter. As well as some many problems of physics. There is even a theory of renormalization that applies to some problem of classical mechanics, like quantum chaos or turbulence. And this is both specific to this and this. And this is, in fact, those two aspects are deeply connected by a theory of renormalization group, renormalization theory, that has been developed along the decades. But the most important contribution is a contribution by Ken Wilson, who the Nobel Prize of Physics was both made very important contribution in high energy physics and in statistical mechanics, and which provided a unified point of view of why renormalization is needed in high energy physics and why it's very important for some aspects, problems in condensed matter and statistical mechanics. So it's called now the Wilsonian renormalization group approach. Okay, so I'm going to discuss that and make the connection with the course of statistical mechanics. So we'll recognize concepts that you have been introduced to by Pedro. And finally, of course, although I am a theoretician, so I'm not dealing with some everyday application of quantum field theory, like high energy physics. For me, it's an everyday application. I'm going to introduce gauge theories, quantization of gauge theories, you may object if you find that my writing becomes too bad. Okay, so gauge theories. So you have been introduced to quantization of gauge theories in the QFT1 course on the example of Maxwell theory and quantum electron dynamics. But of course, we are going to extend that in non-abelian gauge theories, which are the building blocks of the theory of fundamental interactions. And so I will discuss both the formalism of how you quantize and how and why you can renormalize those theories using, in particular, functional integral quantization methods. And I'm going to discuss, depending on the time, some other aspects which are very important, like symmetry breaking, the X mechanism, depending on time. So I hope to at least discuss, as I did last years, make an introduction to the X mechanism, which is something very important. Okay. So, any questions? Oral or by texto? Okay. Okay. So, first, let me move to the other blackboards. Okay, so first, So I hope at the end of this lecture to have introduced you to the idea of quantizing the Klein-Gordon fields, the scalar, spinless, neutral fields that describes a collection of bosons by functional integrals. But before that, let me just, just to be sure that we share the same notation and the same understanding, try to remind, I hope, what Maite did in the quantum theory by presenting the path integral quantization for a single non-relativistic systems, because after all, fields are generalization of ordinary quantum mechanics to system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom or an infinite number of particles. Okay, so let's consider first non-relativistic quantum mechanics on the simple example of one particle with a mass m in a potential v, and so the degrees of freedom of the classical particle is just the position. So I know the position q, you can write it x, q, and of course the classical particles, the position vary in time, so you have time, so this is a position q as a function of time. The velocity is q dot of t, dq over dt is the derivative of the position with respect to time t, and the momentum of the particle is this p equals the mass of the particles that q dot. And you know that the classical theory of classical theory you can and so you have a potential v which depends on q. So this is the potential energy of particle, this is at the position v. And I'm going to consider the case where the potential is time independent, so energy is conserved. And in particular, a well-known example is just the harmonic oscillator. Where V of Q is M over 2 times omega squared Q squared, where omega is the pulsation or the vibration of. Okay. And now you have seen with both Maite, but with David Kubisniak in the front end on classical mechanics, that you can formulate classical mechanics in terms both either an Hamiltonian formulation. So we have an Hamiltonian H, which is a function of P and Q and P. Let me write Q and P. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The Hamiltonian is a function of the position and the momentum. And it's p squared over divided by 2m plus v of q. So it's a function of q and p. Or by an action. This is a Hamiltonian formulation. This is a Lagrangian formulation. So the action is associated to a trajectory, an history of the particles. So you have time here. You have the position, and I'm assuming that Q is just one dimensional. So the particles live on a line. So this is an history of the trajectory of the particles. It's a function Q of T. And to any possible trajectory, not necessarily a trajectory satisfying the equation of motion of the particle, you can associate an action S. So it's a functional of the function that to a given time associates the position at time t. So it's a function of the function q of t. And but this action is just the integral of a time of a of an action density of a Lagrangian L, which is a function of q and of the velocity, position of the velocity, where L of q dot, is seemingly the same thing than this. That's m, but that's m over 2 times the velocity squared minus v of q. Okay. And the relation between the Hamiltonian formalism and the Lagrangian formalism this is a Lagrangian L. This is a Lagrangian function. Is that if you start from the Hamiltonian formulation, one of the equation of motion of the Hamiltonian is that just that the velocity q dot is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to p, and you obtain obviously this equation. And then the action here for a trajectory can be written as integral dt p times q dot minus h of q and p. So if you have this, you write this condition and you replace p by q dot, you obtain the action. So it's some kind of a, it's what's called the Legendre transform. Okay. And this relation between the Hamiltonian formalism and the Lagrangian formalism leads to a lot of consequences. For instance, I think in one of the lectures by David, you have seen what's called the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, the Hamilton-Jacobi formulation of quantum mechanics, which is very useful for many studying many classical systems, which rely on this relation between the action and the Hamiltonian. Okay. Okay. So this is about classical theory. Now, what about the quantum? No question? Okay. So now, what about the quantum theory? Well, you all know that in the quantum theory, in the canonical formulation, you replace classical quantities by operators. Operators acting on the quantum states, which are vectors in a Hilbert space. So classical quantities, which are functions, are replaced by operators, which are matrices. So you have the momentum is replaced by an operator, let me call it p hat. In my lecture notes, I'm not using the hat, but here I'm going to try to. Position operator is replaced by an operator q hat. And the Hamiltonian operator h, the Hamiltonian is replaced by an Hamiltonian operator, which is p hat squared divided by 2m plus the operator v of q hat. So it's a function of an operator, and this defines another operator. For instance, for the harmonic operator, v of q hat is just q hat squared times m omega squared divided by u. So this is a quantum Hamiltonian. Okay, and of course, p and q satisfies the famous commutation relation, because since they are matrices, they do not commute, which is I h bar, where h bar is a Planck's constant divided by 2 pi. So that's non-commuting. Okay. And from this, if you know this, if you know the Hamiltonian, you know, if you know the Hilbert space, you know how the Hamiltonian acts on the states of Hilbert space, the quantum states, you can compute the evolution, quantum evolution of the system. Okay. And well, the dynamics, which here is be given by the either the Hamilton equation of motion or the Euler-Lagrange equation of motion, is replaced by an operator acting on quantum states, and is given by an evolution operator. What you have seen with Maite, and the evolution operator tells you how a quantum state psi at psi zero at time zero evolves into a state psi t at time t. And this evolution operator is just given by an operator u hat of t, so I'm assuming that this is just u hat of t acting on the initial state. And u hat of t is just a function of the Hamiltonian, which is the ordinary exponential function times t divided by I h bar. That's a phase times the Hamiltonian operator. Okay, so this is called the evolution operator. Okay. And you see here where quantum appears, because it's one over h bar. And of course, what did I wanted to say? You can check that this relation, if you differentiate with respect to time, this is equivalent to Schrödinger equation. Okay. So this notation, where you have quantum states, wave functions, if you want, cats of your systems evolving with time, with this relation, is the formulation of quantum mechanics in what's called the Schrödinger picture. Okay. Now I think in her course, Maite introduced you with a somehow a bit more subtle concept, which is the concept of imaginary time. Did she? I've seen it in the notes. It's a bit hidden in the notes, but I presume she insisted on that. So this is the evolution at what's called physical, of course, real time. Well, time is the ordinary time of classical mechanics. Euclidean, it's a concept of time that goes back to Newton and predecessors, maybe Newton, and if you are a bit in news, maybe Quanq, maybe Kant too. But anyway, so that's how everyday lifetime. Okay, but physicist and mathematician, when you have real variables, they often like to make it complex. Sometimes it gives some insights of the mathematical structure of the theory. And both for mathematical reason and for physical reason, it's interesting to consider imaginary time by promoting t to a complex variable. So here is my time variable. It varies along a real axis from past to future. But imagine that now that time is a complex variable. And in particular, it may happen, what's happening if it's a purely imaginary variable? What's happening if you write that t is minus I tau, where tau is going to be called the Euclidean time or imaginary. Well, you do this, you close your eyes on mathematical subtleties, and you write what is the evolution operator u hat of minus I tau. Well, this is simply exponential of minus I tau divided by I h bar, so it's minus tau divided by h bar times the same operator, Hamiltonian operator. Okay, and so let me call this the Euclidean evolution operator of tau. Well, I think you have seen already why it's called Euclidean, but I'm going to explain that again in a few times. So for instance, don't ask why poor Euclides, the Greek mathematician who know nothing about quantum theory, is involved in this. Okay, so this is another operator, but this is a unitary operator. While this is the exponential of a real, so this is an Hermitian operator, so it's something, it's a real operator, and therefore this is a positive definite operator. So it's Hermitian, and positive definite. Yes?
I just have a quick question on the choice of the Euclidean time.
Yes.
Why do we choose precisely to be to just make the purely imaginary part, and why couldn't we do something with?
You can you can choose a time everywhere here or here, and it's useful for some. It's useful sometimes, but what I'm going to explain is that it's a bad idea to consider a complex time or imaginary time in the upper half plane. And the reason is the following. Well, consider, for instance, the harmonic oscillator. That's a simple case, but there is a general theory of that that has been built by mathematicians. So everything that I'm going to explain here, you can find it in real math books with theorems and control about everything and a proper definition of the algebra of operator and which kind of Hilbert space it's working on. Okay, so consider the harmonic oscillator. So this is a potential. And you know that when you quantize the harmonic oscillator, you get energy levels, eigenstate. This is a ground state. This is the first excited state, and the harmonic oscillator that very well known. And so basically, you have energy eigenstates. Let me call them n. N goes from 0, 1 to ta 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 ta. And you have energy eigenvalues, which are En, with E0 less than E1, less than E2, etc. And therefore, well, the Hamiltonian, you can, yes?
There's a question here about why you chose the positive tau axis to be pointing down.
That's because I'm going to choose tau to be positive, as I draw here. It's just a choice. I start from t, I make it a complex variable, and I'm going to explain that this makes sense if tau is positive. And the reason is very simple. Okay. You can diagonalize h. Well, that's an exercise that I'm sure. H is the sum over I, the states of ei, times the projector on the state, eigenstate I, which you can write like this, ket times a bra. So that's an operator. Okay. And therefore, ue of tau, you can write it as sum over I, from 0 to infinity, of exponential of minus tau over h bar ei, that's a number, times the projector. Because of course, exponential of the Hamiltonian commutes with the Hamiltonian, so they can be diagonized simultaneously, and that's over. And you see that since the energy level grow, this becomes smaller and smaller. As long as tau is positive. So, roughly speaking, this is a series which is convergent when you sum over I, provided that tau is positive. Because this term is smaller and smaller and smaller, the higher in energy you go. Okay? While, of course, if tau is negative, this grows with I. Yes?
It's not a positive root. It has to be greater than the lowest energy level.
Pardon?
The condition on tau is not to be positive.
Yes.
But it should be greater than the lowest energy level.
Yes. Did I draw? No, I didn't say anything about whether this is the first energy level is negative or positive. I just need, this is always real, even if E not is negative. The point is that the Hamiltonian has to be the spectrum of the Hamiltonian has to be bounded from below. In other words, you need a ground state. If you have a quantum system with an Hamiltonian whose spectrum is not bounded from below, it means that it can decay. And the system is not stable. So that's interesting. There are a lot of interesting systems where you were studying how a quantum system decays. For instance, if you have a system which is like that, say, if you have a particle in a potential with growth like that, the potential is like that. So you have it is in a well. So it has eigenstates, but they can tunnel by quantum tunneling into this part where there is no ground state or a different ground state. So this is an example of a theory where the spectrum of the Hamiltonian approximated in this well is in fact not bounded from below because you have states here which are problematic. Okay, so that's problematic. Okay, so if the spectrum is bounded from below, this operator is well defined. This series is well defined and define an operator if tau is negative. Okay. And well, that's a bit unwavering, but in fact, the mathematical theory of that is that you want that the evolution operator ue of tau to be what's called the bounded operator Uh, in the theory of operator acting on Hilbert space. So that's a theory of operator algebra. Theory. Okay, and there are great names of mathematicians associated to theory, first starting by John von Neumann. But also Banach, etc. Okay, and that's a very lively theory even now of mathematics. And in fact, you have people now at the Institute involved in that. Mathematical physicists involved in operator algebra theory. Okay, and yes?
Can we have some finite level system that has the
bound
from above, a theory that has finite energy level?
Oh, yes, of course. But if you have a finite energy level, if you have a finite number of energy levels, everything we are dealing with matrices with finite size. And in that case, that's OK. Yeah. So we need a spectrum which is bounded from below and infinite. Yeah. So we are doing a physics of physical systems. And for instance, in quantum information systems, people like very much to reduce your system to a system with a finite number of quantum states. For instance, a qubit has two, a combination of two qubits has four, etc. Because then you have this full theory of gates represented as matrices, and there are lots of interesting mathematics going on to that. But when dealing with a system of a photon in a box or a phonon in a crystal, and especially in quantum physics theory, where you can have an arbitrary number of particles in your theory, your spectrum is infinite. So, and that's related to the fact that the mathematical theory of algebra. Of operator algebra of operator, let me finish, acting on Hilbert space is much richer than the theory of matrices, of algebra of matrices. Okay, yes?
Does the evolution operator in imaginary time converge if we have an infinite number of negative energy eigenvalues?
No, then it's problematic. You mean if EI becomes you mean?
Could be still bounded.
Ah, yes. Okay. No, then it makes sense because, in fact, this theory I've explained very, by unwaving arguments what's happening if you have a discrete spectrum. But this theory applies when you have a spectrum with a continuum. If you have a potential like that. Okay. You have a well. You have a particle, but you have a well somewhere in space. So of course, you may very well have, energy states where the particle is trapped in the well. That's called localized states. So the states are localized in the well. This is the position. This is still Q. But then, of course, if the particle is energetic enough, it gets out of the well, and then it can move, so you have plane waves. So here you have a continuum of extended states. Just plane waves where particles move. So it's just a plane wave of ordinary quantum mechanics. But then something happens somewhere here. So it can be a bit reflected here, continued here. But still, it doesn't fall into the well because it has a high enough energy. Okay, and this makes sense for quantum system with an extended, continuous state. You have to replace the sum by an integral over measure. So it's a theory of of operators with both the discrete spectra and the continuous spectra, but it makes sense too. Yes?
Can we use that when we treat antiparticles to say, say to explain the change in energy by saying, oh, the Euclidean time will have the opposite sign, time positive for particles?
At that level, I'm doing with non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So I'm not dealing with Dirac theory. But I think this you can do that for quantum theory too. For Dirac, so the non-relativistic, well, the one particle, the Dirac theory, one particle. But remember that the energy of an antiparticle is still positive. So in terms of spectrum, you have particles, you have antiparticles, but both the states of the particles and the states of the antiparticles of the holes is positive when you excite sets. And that's happened everywhere in condensed matter. You know, if you have a semiconductors, you can excite, you have an electron that gets out of the conduction band, it creates a holes, but both the particles and the holes can move independently, and they do, but they still have positive energy. Okay. So it's okay too. Okay. So in this case. So thank you for the question. Okay. So basically, and of course, let's come back to this general definition of the evolution operator as a function of time, where time is a complex variable. So basically, the evolution operator U of t is bounded here, everywhere, here. Here it's Hermitian positive. Here it's unitary, as it should for operator acting on quantum states. And here it's not bounded. Okay.
Sorry,
yes?
Where is not bounded?
It's not bounded in the upper half plane. So let's call it.
Oh, when
U of t is unbounded if the imaginary part of time is positive. And so we are, it's something which is out of the mathematical framework which is available to deal with quantum systems. So we should not consider those. Okay. And it's bounded if m of t is 0, real axis, real time, or imaginary. Okay. Okay. So you should keep in mind this picture. So it's becoming a bit messy. Okay. Okay. So now, path integrals. So this was an introduction, but I think it's good to have everything in mind. So, I refer to Maite. And of course, the theory of path integral formulation is mainly due to Feynman. Okay, this confirmation. Okay, so you have seen from Maite course that if you are interested into the probability amplitudes, amplitude that a particle, where is the cross here? That a particle moves at some initial time zero from a position q to a finite time to another position. So this is called few final. So I consider the position eigenstates QF, I consider U of T, the evolution operator, and I sandwich it with the ket of the position eigenstate at position QI. So this is this can be represented as a functional integral over trajectories. So what I'm doing is that I'm representing here time. I'm representing it position. So this is my initial. This is my final state. I assume that the particle is localized at QI at time zero. I want to know what is the probability amplitude that it's at position QF. So this is Q initial, and this is Q final at time t. And there is it. Evolution is quantum in between, in this time interval. This is just been given by a sum over all the histories, so to given times, intermediate time times s, the position at the, is at the position q of s, and I average over all those histories, all those paths, with a phase which is exponential I over h bar times the action of the trajectory. So this is a trajectory or history. To each history is associated a phase, quantum phase. And of course, you sum over all the trajectories, which are that, such that at time zero, you are in the initial position. At that time t, you are in the final position. So you are not allowed to consider a history that goes there or there. OK. So this is Feynman's path integral formulation. And of course, in order to derive this equation, Maite showed you the initial reasoning of argument of Feynman, which consists in cutting this time interval into some small interval. And this allows to define properly what is the action and what is this measure. So you have a measure on trajectories. And there are some subtleties associated to the measure on trajectories. OK? OK. So I think Maite showed you also that, of course, this is the probability amplitudes to evolve from QI to QF during a real time. But you have a equivalent formulation, because this is a mathematical relation. This is just a way to write mathematically this number. You can work out a Feynman path integral at Euclidean time or imaginary time. Okay? And, well, it's just the question is, can you represent in a similar way the matrix, that's the matrix element of an operator for UE of tau? So can I represent QF UE of tau to initial? Okay. And the answer to this question is basically that you have to be more careful, but basically, you make this transformation in all the formula and you see what's the result. And the result is that this is going to be now a path integral over all trajectory that depends on Euclidean time, sigma. This is sigma is an Euclidean time. So the Euclidean times evolves between 0 and tau. So we are considering trajectories that depends on the different variable. Okay? But you still consider trajectories that start at Euclidean time 0 at q initial, that end up at final Euclidean time tau equal sigma equal tau at qf. So we consider trajectories that belongs, roughly speaking, to the same state, of the same big space of trajectories. But now, instead of having trajectories weighted by a phase, so this is a phase, there, the trajectories are weighted by a positive real number. So it's a weight. And that's exponential minus 1 over h bar times a quantity which is called the Euclidean action of the trajectory. So this is an Euclidean action. Okay. And I'm going to write this Euclidean action in a minute, but Maite wrote it already. But the boundary condition are the same. So q at time 0 is q initial. Q at the final Euclidean time tau is q final. Same space of trajectory with the same initial and final boundary condition. But now we have so this is exponential. I'm sorry, there are two exponential. Okay. So let me first write the Euclidean action. As E of Q. Well, you just have to see what's happening when I over h bar s of q, what does it becomes when you replace t by minus I tau. So then the integral, so remember s of q, s, so the, let me call the real-time action, is s of q equal integral over dt, ds from 0 to t of q dot squared divided by 2m minus v of q. Well, you replace the time by minus I tau, so you replace s by minus I sigma. So there is a minus I factor that comes out, but is going to be compensated by this one. Then you get minus v of q, but you get also, now you have some I factor which come from the derivative of q. Because this is q dot here is going to be becomes the derivative with respect to sigma. So we end up with integral from 0 to tau d sigma. Sigma is the intermediate value, and the particle is at the position q sigma as Euclidean time sigma. So this is Euclidean time. Okay, and then you can check that what you get is q dot squared divided by 2m plus v of q. So this is Euclidean action. To be compared to the ordinary action that I wrote a bit earlier. Okay. So, important point, there is a plus sign here. Okay, yes?
The mass should be upstairs, shouldn't it? Like on the...
Pardon?
Should be the mass, it should be mq dot...
Yes, I'm very sorry, that's... yeah, no, I'm sure it's... Yes, of course. Sorry. This momentum. Yes. Thank you. Yes. And so this is a real number. So this is this quantity here. What's called a positive weight. So to each trajectory, you associate a positive real number, which can be viewed as some probability weight, instead of associating to a trajectory here, a phase, a quantum phase. So here, we have a quantum phase. And when you sum over trajectory with phases, of course, what you're going to get is quantum interference. So the particles will behave like a wave. Here, you have a positive weight, so you just have a theory of probability theory on trajectories. So you have random trajectories, and you weight them with some probability. Okay, and you see that both terms are positive if the, for instance, if you are dealing with the harmonic potential. So if the trajectory fluctuates widely, the velocity in Euclidean time is larger. So the weight becomes smaller. And in the same time, if the trajectory wanders far away from the origin, the potential becomes larger. Therefore, the probability weight becomes smaller. So in other words, in this formulation, quantum mechanics at imaginary time, the particles likes to stay there in this ground state, in this classical ground states. Okay. Okay, so this is basic theory that you have seen, I think, with Maite of path integral formulation of quantum mechanics at physical real time and at imaginary time. Here we have trajectory weighted by quantum phases. Here you have trajectory in Euclidean time weighted by your probability weight. Okay. So I want elaborate on that, but I think you have made such object in the statistical mechanical course, because if you want to ask yourself what kind of objects are those trajectories, those kind of random walks, this is deeply related to the theory of random walks and Brownian motions. Basically, you have a particle that moves with a weight proportional to the with velocity squared. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that because I'm going to see when you deal with quantum field theory, what is a generalization of a quantum, of a random walk. And this is going to be called the Gaussian free field in higher. Okay. Okay, so maybe. Yes. Sorry, it was making too much.
What does the Gaussian means in the Gaussian free field?
It means a simple fact that if you restrict this general formulation in the case of the harmonic oscillator, V of Q is Q squared. So the Euclidean action is Q dot squared plus Q squared. So it's a quadratic form. So you have the exponential of something which is quadratic in Q. In fact, a free field non-interacting, a free particle or a free field in an harmonic potential, so a non-interacting object, is described by Gaussian path integral. Because simply, we are dealing with the ordinary theory of Gaussian integrals, Gaussian probabilities, generalized from ordinary probability distribution to trajectories or random walks. And you have seen that with the thing. Okay. So Gaussian, in fact, is more or less equivalent to free. But mathematicians call this Gaussian free field. Okay. So, finally, maybe I'll do that here, because I want to have time to address a bit the Gaussian free field. Okay. So, mid here is working. I still have a bit of space here. Of course, we have dealt only with the ordinary, the matrix element of the evolution operator. But I think Maite, I showed you in a simple example also how you compute matrix element of operators. So operators. So observable of the quantum theory. And of course, well, the simplest observable are just observable of the position. So consider a function A of the position of the particle. That's a classical observable. You quantize it. It becomes an operator A hat, which is the function A of the quantum operator A of Q. So for instance, if A is a polynomial in Q, A hat is the corresponding polynomial in the operator Q. Okay. And you may ask, what does correspond to the following path integral? So I'm going to deal with that at physical time, but so I'm considering a path integral by integrate over all trajectories, starting from Q initial, ending to Q final. So I'm considering this big object. But let me consider that at a given time, T1, I, in some sense, add to the path integral the value A of Q at time t1. And at a given time t2, I add in the path integral A of Q at time t2. Of course, I can do that for 1, operator, two operator, three operators, and well, I can also well add a different operator, a different function b of q. Okay, so I compute this object, which is basically integral b of q exponential I over h bar the action of these trajectories, but I multiplied this phase by the number a of q at time t1, and then I multiply by the number b of q at time t2. So a and b are some functions. And this is an operator. Well, you work out the bit of a formalism of a path integral by first considering that you are doing a path integral from here to here. Then you are doing a path integral from here to here. And then you are doing a path integral from here to here. Okay. And it's an exercise. You end up with a matrix element in the quantum theory, but slightly more complicated. So let me write it from right to left, because time goes this way. So first, I start from the initial state, the ket qi. Then I evolve by free evolution of my systems up to time t1. So I can add u of t1. Then I'm doing something by adding this a. And in fact, what I'm doing is that I'm adding the operator a hat. Oh, u is an operator, so it's u hat. Here it's an operator, u hat, etc. Okay, then I have a free quantum evolution from time t1 to time t2. So I had a quantum evolution operator from time t1 to time t2. So this is t2 minus t1. Okay? Then, same game. I'm adding the operator b hat. Then I freely evolve from t2 to t. So I get u of t minus t2. And then I take the scalar product of this object. This is a vector with the final state qf. So this is what I'm considering. And so inserting operator in the path, inserting local function in the path integral is equivalent to compute matrix element of products of operator. So this is a matrix element in Schrödinger. Representation. But another way to write this object, which is more compact, is to use the Heisenberg representation. Heisenberg picture, which is just a different way to represent quantum amplitudes, where I consider that my initial state qi, I note it qi at time zero. My final states, I represent it at qf at time t. And a hat, well, u hat of t1, a hat, u hat of minus t1 is just the operator a what of t1. So operator a hat apply that at T1 in Schrödinger in Heisenberg picture. And similarly, B hat U hat of T2 U dagger of minus T2 is the operator B hat at time T2, is just going from QI, QF, A hat, and B hat in Heisenberg picture to those operators and those states is just a unitary transformation. So that's, we are computing the same probability amplitudes. And this becomes just in the Heisenberg picture, the matrix element of QF at time TF with QI at time zero. Well, T is TF, T final. And here I have a hat of T1 times a hat, well, B hat of T2. So it's just another compact notation to write the same object. Okay. So this path integral represented by this picture corresponds to this matrix element, which is a matrix element between initial and final states of a product of quantum operators associated to different times, T1 and T2. Okay. So of course, well, this is valid in this picture. Yes?
Shouldn't we have a U of TF? So it is U of TF QF, U minus TF QF equal to Q.
Yeah, no, but that's because simply because you see, this U hat of T2 minus T1 is just U hat of minus T1 times U hat of T2.
Yes, but you see, it doesn't work with the last U. So the U, that's between QF and B.
No, that works because U of T minus T2 is U hat of T times U hat of minus T2. So you see, I start from this. I get a U hat of T2 on the left, on the right of B hat, and I have a U hat of minus T2 on the left of B hat. So I get B hat of T2.
And then for the QFT, you need QFT would be QF?
Ah, yes, no, yeah, yeah. So, no, okay. So Q, well, QF of T is defined as U hat of T.
Minus T.
No, yeah. For QF, this is U hat. But when I take its adjoint, which is a bra, QF T, so this is the adjoint of the ket. So the adjoint of this is the adjoint of U hat. So this is U hat of minus T times the adjoint of the bra, of the ket QF, which is a bra QF.
No, but I said the minus is because precisely you want those relationship with a minus sign. You want
oh yes, no, it's so it's minus. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is minus T. Yeah, and this is a plus T. Yes. So, yeah. So this is a proper definition of the. Of the Schrödinger picture. You go from operator in the Schrödinger picture into operator in the Heisenberg picture by putting evolution operator to the right and adjoint of evolution operator to the left. And you go from kets in the Schrödinger picture to kets in the Heisenberg picture by putting adjoint of U hat to the left so that those cancels with those. Yeah, yeah, thank you. And with this notation, everything is is a yeah. Thank you. Even after decades, I still get one. Okay. Okay, so let me go back. I won't have time to discuss the free field, but that's not a problem. We'll do that tomorrow. So let's go back to this relation. So we have seen that this picture is going to be a bit messy, but this picture corresponds to this matrix element in the Heisenberg picture. But now, so this corresponds to what's going on when you have T, T1, T2, and here I have A, and here I have B. But of course, in this path integral, I am summing over trajectories. So, and this is a number, this is a quantum phase. This is a number, and this is a number. It's not an operator. That's a number. And so they commute. You have no problem of ordering. So you may ask, what's going on if instead of doing that, I compute exactly the same path integral over the same path, but I assume that instead of having T1 less than T2, between 0 and T, I have T1 larger than T2. So I have 0 less than T2, less than T1, less than T. Of course, nothing changed in this. You are computing the same kind of integral. But now, of course, you have first apply u hat of T2 to B, then u hat of T1 minus T2 times A times u of T minus T1. So what you are getting is qf of t, well, qi, b hat of t2, a hat of t1 times qf t. So then, instead of having a hat of t1 times b hat of t2, what you get is that b hat of t2 times a hat of t1. So in other words, what the path integral formulation builds is the time ordered product. So you get T, so you get what's called the time ordered product. Of A and B. And Maite introduce you to this definition of a time-ordered product of operator. So if you have operator which are in the Heisenberg picture applied at different times, you automatically order them so that smaller time and on the right, so apply to the kets before later time. And so you see the path integral, Feynman's path integrals, automatically order in time the operator. Path integrals of Feynman's automatically built up the time ordered operator. That's how it works. Okay. And of course, if you have some operator which commutes with the Hamiltonian, they commute with the evolution operator, so time ordering is not important. But if A and B and H do not commute, then there is a difference between A times B and B times A. You see. So, which means that in fact, this formulation of quantum mechanics in path integral seems to be very classical. You just, instead of considering single classical trajectory, you consider quantum trajectory weighted by quantum phases. But in fact, hidden in this formulation are contained the commutation relation. Well, they are not hidden. They are just not easy to see just when you look at that. They are, for instance, hidden or contained in the path integral. Okay, and for instance, it's a nice exercise to check by considering the operator Q. So exercise, consider the operator Q hat, which is the correspondent for Q of t, and consider the operator P hat, which is, remember, P hat in the classical theory is m times q squared. So basically, this is going to be m times d over dt. So you know that p hat is m d over dt of q hat of t in the Hamiltonian formulation. So it's related to m q dot of t in the path integral. So you can weight in your path integral to have q here and the derivative of q here. So here you have the position of the particle. Here you have the velocity. The question is recover q hat p hat equal high h bar, which is a quantum term. And in fact, it works. So hidden in the path integral is the fact that quantum operators do not commute. Okay, so let me end here. I was hoping to get a bit more advanced, but I think that's good, especially since I had anonymous and non-anonymous questions. So thank you. And next time, so tomorrow, we'll see how everything applies in a seemingly but often trivial way to a quantum system, to a quantum field theory, namely the free field. And then I'll explain, but I probably you, most of them have already seen, I'll explain why this imaginary time that I introduced here is called Euclidean time. Thank you.